Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
And we're talking with Philip Baer of HomeHarvestFarms.com. And you've mentioned, though, one of the weak spots could be the seeds. What are we going to do about that?
That is something that by having this conversation, hopefully people will be listening to what we're talking about and seeing the opportunities for doing something with that. But if nobody comes up with some way of dealing with that aspect of the climate crisis and the peak oil crisis and the population crisis that are all converging right now, it's an end game for human beings, potentially.
Well, we're going to have to be more than growers. We're going to have to be seed savers as well, and there's techniques to be learned, but it's not that hard. People have been doing it for thousands of years, so I guess we have to take on that mantle as well.
That is probably one of the most important roles for people in our society today who want to make a valuable contribution.
Okay. Well, we're starting to run out of time, Philip. I'm wondering if there's other things that you'd like to talk with us about.
The one thing that's on my mind is a concern about the agricultural lands proximate to Vancouver that are being threatened by rising sea levels, where already we're starting to see water infiltrating, saltwater infiltrating, and destroying our ability to grow food in these places. These are Richmond and Delta and parts of the Fraser Valley. And before we lose that rich agricultural land, I would love to see these cities adopting forms of agriculture that raise the agriculture above the ground using systems like the style of system that I've designed, because I believe that we're going to need to be eating food from as close by as possible, and it would be a terrible shame to lose both these places and the fertile soil that's there today.
You know, I've looked into that, and this is a problem in many places where we broadcast. San Francisco is one for sure, because salinity could work its way all the way up to Sacramento through the water system they've got there. It's a big problem. Rising seas is a threat, and of course, the storm surges that drive them. We've got the same thing going on in Chesapeake Bay. That's a big agricultural area, and a lot of good growing land could be lost. And when we look around the world, we find out that the best growing lands are in river deltas right by the sea. That's where a large part of the world population is currently located. So we've got to stop climate change before it wipes out our agricultural capabilities, or millions will starve. And it's possible millions will starve anyway, but we hope not, and we're going to try and prevent this from happening. And as you've told us today, growing your own food is something that each of us can do to lower the climate threat. So I want to thank you very much for coming by and stopping in and talking with us today. Our guest has been Philip Baer. He's with HomeHarvestFarms.com here in Vancouver. You can find that on the internet and look at the products that some of which, did you invent some of those products?
All of those have been designed by me. All of the soil-based products have been designed by me.
Right. Okay. So he's worked it up himself, and I think we've got some original material here that some of you will be interested in. Thank you so much for listening. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I am Alex Smith. In a little bit, we are going to talk with Walter Haugen, an outdoor grower in Washington State. But first, I'd like to share a few more notes about growing indoors under lights. In my mind, there's a hierarchy of home agriculture. First and foremost, we do almost all of our gardening under the sun as nature intended it. That's where most of your growing should happen, whether it's on your city lot or pots in the patio or wherever you've got. Maybe a community garden. Second, we grab the harvest when it's there. Get the book Putting Food By to find out how in detail for every kind of food. Freezing has its place, especially for the berries, but I still prefer drying food and canning the rest. That way we don't depend on the grid or use still more fossil fuels just to keep our food over the winter. Anybody with a yard can build a root cellar or use a basement to store a harvest plenty, and when prices are cheap and the local food abounds, that's the time to get it. Only after that, or in unusual circumstances, would I supplement the real solar harvest with food and herbs grown indoor under lights. It's super legitimate to get seeds and seedlings started under a few fluorescent bulbs in the spring. Speaking of that, I dragged out my old 24-inch two-bulb fluorescent grow lamp from 15 years ago to compare it to the new model Philip Baer brought me. There has been a ton of progress in fluorescent grow lamps, mainly due to stimulation from the multi-billion dollar pot growing industry. My old fluorescent lamp is big, it has a ballast noisy with a hum you can hear, and the main difference is in its pure sunlight brightness. The old fluorescents with 8 watts per bulb look pale and pasty compared to the T5 Sunblaster I got from Philip. That's a single bulb, 24 watts in a 24-inch model. It doesn't hum. It's slim and it's lightweight. It appears to come from a company called Future Harvest Development, and that has a website called extremegrowing.com. Adding the optional Nanotech T5 reflector forces all the light downward toward the plant where it should be. Just eyeballing it, this new unit is far brighter in the spectrums that count than the old fluorescent grow bulbs you may have seen a few years ago. And the new ones run cool. That means you can get them closer to the leaves where the light needs to be. One 24-inch light with an on-off switch sells for $32 in Canada. The reflector is another $20. You could make your own out of aluminum foil, but I like the reflector that fits the unit well. My only beef with the low-end unit I got from Philip at Home Harvest Farms is the wire supports meant to hold that light up. It isn't reliable. It's just poked into the soil, and when that soil shifts, as it will when you water it, the light can fall down. I built a light stand using a 2x2 and a 1x1, both 8 feet long, plus 8 screws and one metal L-bracket. The whole thing cost less than $8. You can find a photo of that little light stand at my blog at ecoshock.info. That way I can use cheap chain to raise and lower the lights as the plants start out or as they grow. Future Harvest also sells a light stand for the T5. It does look better, but I don't think it would extend high enough for the deep trays that Philip provided. My first intention was simply to have some fresh herbs for the kitchen when cooking. In that scenario, you hope the herbs will grow enough that you can pick them without killing the plant. You're not trying to get them to flower, and you don't want them to go to seed. What if I did want to grow some lettuce and then save the seed? Or even a small bush mini tomato plant? When the plants were mature enough, I would have to change the light bulb in the fluorescent. Most plants depend on subtle light signals to fruit or bloom, the kind of redness in the sky that happens later in the season. The normal vegetative bulb in my unit is rated at 6400K. That K stands for Kelvin. It's a standard way of measuring the light waves, known as color temperature. Look it up in Wiki. To stimulate fruit and bloom, I would change to a color temperature of 2700K. That's a more ready orange shade. You would have to order that from a local dealer. As soon as I set up my unit, I noticed other changes. When you transplant basil, for example, its aroma fills the room for several days until it settles down. I hope you like basil. Next, the cat showed up. She did not nibble any leaves. These were not on her menu. But Kitty likes to lay down in front of the planter under the fake sunlight on a dreary day. Sooner or later, some unwelcome insects will also find my kitchen garden. They always do. I'll have to have some non-toxic insecticidal soap on the ready for the aphids. Of course, having some extra sunlight in the room adds some cheer. I've noticed it. I've got the lights on a timer, running 16 hours with 8 hours of darkness. That has worked well for me in the past, but if you have better info, let me know. So I'm looking at vegetative plants like herbs and salad fixings. I bought some small herbs in tiny pots already growing to stock up. 2 of cilantro, we like pesto here, a basil plant, 2 oregano, and 1 thyme plant. The rest of the planter will go to heirloom lettuce, likely either very dark or colored leaves. But what if I want more, like the holy grail of indoor gardeners, the tomato? Frankly, those plants are overrated for the watts they consume. Why not plant things like beets where you can eat the roots and the tops instead of throwing out most of the plant? If you want tomatoes, you need more serious lights, in my opinion. A 600-watt bulb would do one plant. A A 1,000-watt bulb would grow several large tomato plants. You can buy those. Again, you would have to buy maybe a 1,000-watt fruiting bulb at 2,700K to make the tomatoes happen. The electricity expense will never justify the cost of those tomatoes. But you can get fresh heirloom tomatoes when they are ripe in December anytime, and you know that they don't have pesticides all over them. Perhaps if we subtract all the fossil-based fertilizers and insecticides that you didn't use, the tractor fuel and the trucking emissions to bring them north, the cost of carbon might even out. If you know anyone who has done these calculations, please write me. The address is radio@ecoshock.org. As I said, I wouldn't take on the big lights at all if your electricity comes from coal or nuclear fuel. Could you grow with solar power? Well, certainly you could, using these modern high-powered fluorescents. The 4-foot-long bulbs put out 54 watts of power. That's twice as bright, without using very much juice. You might still need either wind power or the grid to back you up after a week of cloudy, rainy weather. Growing plants indoors requires dependable light every day. Otherwise, the plants can stall, and you lose more than just a day or two of growth. Commercial greenhouses use the lights every day without fail. It mainly depends on where you live, doesn't it? If you're in a sunny region, I'll bet you could be growing even during the cold times using a combination of a skylight or greenhouse supplemented with fluorescent grow lights. Please let me know your experiences. Before we get to our next guest, Philip Baer brought up one scary point. The real bottleneck to the new local food movement might be seeds. What if we are too successful? Could the non-GMO seed houses keep up? What if a stock market crash convinces millions of ordinary people to tear up their lawns and plant? Will there be enough seeds? I posed this question to Chris at the Incredible Seed Company, a Canadian outfit that provides heirloom seeds. Chris doesn't sell so-called survival packs, even though he could make some extra money at it. Instead, he recommends you start planting anything, anywhere, and buy a book on how to save seeds. You can't save the seeds from things you grow from Home Depot seeds or Walmart. Unless it says heirloom and non-GMO right on the package, they will be hybrid seeds, and they won't grow true to the form you expect the next year. Your seed saving will be wasted. Anyway, Chris thinks that if there was a sudden move towards local home farming, that there would be enough seeds because the big companies would just divert seeds from farmers, where they don't make a lot of money when they sell them in bulk, to the local market where they can make more money. So probably we would have the seeds, but they'd be GMO seeds. They would be hybrids, so that's not so good. I need to do a whole program on seeds, the survival packs, saving your own, and the various societies like Seed Saviors, and the Seedy Saturday events put out by an outfit called Seeds of Diversity. You can help. Please send me your experiences, your recommendations for products or companies that work for you, or guests I should interview about seeds for Radio EcoShock. Send all those tips to my email box. It's radio@ecoshock.org. With your help, we can do a good program on seeds. It's fun and helpful to talk with small alternative growers around the country and around the world. Right now, we'll go to Walter Haugen, and then I've got a new song for you from the Australian group Pagan Love Cult. I think you'll appreciate both their sound and their message.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. We're going to pay a short visit to a man I'll call the Spreadsheet Farmer. His new book is The Laws of Physics Are on My Side, but he's not a physicist. He has training in anthropology instead. Walter Haugen is an educated wanderer. He's a former field worker, and he's turned into a food grower. Walter, why don't you tell us, where are you located and how much land do you have in production?
Okay, how you doing, Alex? I am located just outside of Ferndale, Washington. It's in the northwest corner of Washington State, so sometimes we call it the fourth corner. And we've got a little farm here. It's a diversified farm. I grow about 60 to 80 different crops, and it's on 5 acres, but I only intensively cultivate 1 to 2 acres, depending on the years. And so, for instance, this last year in 2012 was 1 acre, and then 1.5 that was actually tilled.
And you're doing it as community-supported agriculture as well? Like you're actually selling food out to other people from that amount of land?
Yes, I am. I sell a few CSA shares every year. Last year, I tried something new. I did a gift economy idea where I gave away free CSA shares to, you know, some, to poor people. And, you know, and then asked for donations. Didn't get any, of course. But, you know, I did get, you know, one person who was willing to come out and put some time in. And then I also, you know, I take in volunteers and they come out and work and I pay them in food.
Why are you aiming to go beyond organic?
Well, the thing is that both in keeping the soil clean, being a good soil steward, but also just the energy level, you know, requires us to go organic. I think Richard Heidenberg years ago said, don't even worry about organic because everybody's in 50 years, everybody would be organic anyway. You know, I grew up on a farm and the inputs increased dramatically. The chemical fertilizer inputs increased dramatically after the war and even more so in the 70s. And it's just, it takes so much energy. And the reason we are eating petroleum is because of the, not only the large amount of fuel in tractors, but also just the large amount of fuel that it takes to make the chemical fertilizers. And we don't need to do that. We can actually quantify sustainability. And when we do that, we see that the organic method is better.
Do you have a tractor? And if not, what machines are you using?
I don't have a tractor, and I have a BCS tiller. It's a walk-behind tiller, and it has a standard transmission, you know, 3 speeds forward, 2 back. And it allows me to do an awful lot of work for very low inputs. So, for instance, I can grow 10,000 pounds of food on about 10 to 12 gallons of fuel every year, plus my own labor.
And you use your body as one of the tools of farming.
That's correct. You know, I'm a biological anthropologist, and it's real clear to me that the most efficient engine we have is the human body. We can get an awful lot done on very low inputs. You know, I work long days in the summer, but I don't put out an awful lot of energy. And so my metric is 125 kilocalories per hour, and you can get produce an awful lot of food with that.
Well, Walter Haugen, what are your thoughts on the relationships between climate change and food production?
Well, unfortunately, climate change is in a positive feedback loop now, for instance, because of the adiabatic effect in the Arctic and others. And so we really have to deal with new crops, new varieties in the crops, new ways to grow food. For example, I have 30 different varieties of potatoes, but I'm also developing, I developed two new varieties myself using the seed ball technique that Luther Burbank used, and I'm developing, you know, new varieties of corn that are intrinsic to the Pacific Northwest here, because we're going to need to adapt, you know, these different crops and varieties to climate change. And climate change is not just more carbon dioxide or an overall increase. In this area, for instance, it means longer, cooler springs, and so you have a germination problem. So you have to have seeds that will come up quick, things like that.
Well, I want to tip off listeners to a paper I found in your blog, and it was published in February 2013 by Tufts University, titled Climate Impacts on Agriculture, A Challenge to Complacency. It's by Frank Ackerman and Elizabeth A. Stanton. I'll put a link to that paper in my show blog at ecoshock.info, and we're going to give out your blog information pretty shortly. Well, I want to ask you what varieties of food you grow, but I realize that might take half an hour just to answer that one question. So instead, can you explain why you use a spreadsheet to keep track of what you produce?
Well, you know, I used to be an archaeologist, and I understand how data collection in the field can sort of tweak, or it impacts your methodology, it impacts your theory, it impacts your analysis. So you've got to be rigorous, and one of the ways to be rigorous is you start with a coherent vision of what you're doing. So, for instance, I have every variety and every succession planting I do has its own line in the spreadsheet. And this has the square footage. It has the, you know, variety, the days that it should be ready, you know, et cetera, and comments. And then in my harvest spreadsheet, I have, you know, how many pounds I get per acre of that. And everything is weighed as it comes in from the field in the shop. Everything's weighed, and I'm real rigorous about that because that's necessary. But once I have all this data, I can tell you certain things. For example, I can tell you that I'm in 2012, I had a 25% increase in my efficiency I had basically the same amount of food produced as 2011, but with only $1,500 instead of $2,000. So having all that data in a coherent fashion, in an orderly fashion, shall we say, helps you think in orderly way.
It is March in Washington State. What are you doing to prepare for the coming season?
Okay, right now I already have onions up in my seed flats and transplants, and I'm doing cabbages and other brassicas today, you know, broccoli and cauliflower. Soon, towards the end of March, I'll be doing, tomatoes, and then in April I'll be doing peppers and things like that. I can't get out into the field now because it's far too wet. You don't want to compact your soil and turn it into muck. So right now is my off-season. So, for instance, this time last year, I was writing my book.
Let's talk about that book. Why did you call it The Laws of Physics Are on My Side?
You know, since I'm an anthropologist and a farmer, you know, it appeared to me that the peak oil and the climate change people weren't looking at the intersection of culture and energy. And we've been cultural animals for 2 million years, and it's only in the last 150 million years that we've been able to replace cultural behaviors with just cheap oil energy. And now we just throw more oil energy at any and all problems, and we're losing our ability to adjust. It's as if cheap oil energy has replaced culture. And this is a problem because we're in peak oil now. We're using far too much energy, and it's changing the climate, and these are interactive variables. And so we need to do something different. And part of the book is, about a third of the book is analysis and two-thirds is solutions. And so I wanted to look at it from a historical perspective and also just, put a different spin on it. You know, people buy the modern narrative, you know, and they don't really look at what is actually happening. So, for instance, you know, we have, each of us in the U.S., we have 91 energy slaves at our disposal because of the amount of oil and coal energy we use. And we could get by on much, much less, and we're going to have to in the future, I think.
Well, I appreciated in the back of the book some of your tips from experience about everything from fruit trees to the various vegetable crops that we might grow. Is the book available in electronic form? Where else can we get it? Do you have a website or a blog?
The book is on Amazon, both in a paperback and a Kindle version. And you can buy the Kindle version and download it. There are free apps, so you can download it to your computer and read it if you like. Or you can download it and get a free app for your iPad or your Android. So it's available for people, you know, instantly to read it, like, you know, while they're riding the subway, for instance. My website is www.fafarm.org, and that's mostly a static website. I don't blog much on there anymore because I've got other work to do. If you go to the Transition Whatcom site, which is transitionwhatcom.ning.com, you know, I have lots of blogs on there because, you know, since that's a local site and I'm involved locally, it's to my advantage to try and get my word out locally, see.
So you're involved in the transition movement?
Yes, I have been from the start here in Whatcom County. It's interesting because a lot of the stuff in the transition movement is just a recast of what we were doing in the early 70s. But, you know, hopefully they've got better marketing and they can sort of pull in more people from the perimeters, you know. Back in the 70s, we just, you know, it was difficult to get people on board. And hopefully the transition movement is addressing that. You know, there are pluses and minuses, as with any movement.
You know, I'd like to talk to you longer. We're sort of running out of time here. As we finish up, is there an idea or message that you'd like to add?
Well, the main thing is, as I close my book, you don't change your paradigm in your head. You change your paradigm by getting your hands in the soil. And that's what I think people need to do. Everybody needs to grow some of their own food. You can start with 5%. You can grow a 30 by 30 garden, or you can do some container gardening. But once you get your hands in the soil and actually observe how nature works, that will help change your paradigm and will be better for your survival.
So you can grow by growing. Well, Walter, thank you so much for talking with us.
Okay, you bet. Thanks, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Thanks to a listener from Australia, I've covered Pagan Love Cult. It's the only cult in the world that tries to brainwash its members to think for themselves. PaganLoveCult.com. Visit that website, and for a limited time only, you can hear their inspiring song, You Are Here. We opened the program with a quick clip from their ode to beatnik Neil Cassady. Now here's a full tune with the corporate angst and common folk rising. It's called Everything I Know.
Transition, the end of the line. They were sending in the troopers to defend a private mine. One person in 100 was gonna turn a nice buck, but the rest of the community was out of luck. We thought we lived in paradise, our feet upon the ground. What lies below the surface, though, belongs to the crown. And the government looks after it on behalf of this great nation. They've just gone and sold it to a multinational corporation. And everything I know is telling me that this is the wrong way to go. Every single place I've been, it's always more concrete, encroaching on the green, riding on your economic wave. Why do you eat your own children and dig your own grave? But this is where we make our stand. You might own the courtrooms, but the people own the land. Take a nice piece of bushland, dig a bloody big hole, fill it full of poison, sit back and count your gold. Move on to the next place when this one runs dry. But the water's all connected and there's only one sky. They're coming right at us, anyone can see. No one's gonna save us now, it's down to you and me. Come and help your neighbors stop the bastards getting through. Come and meet the mining company before they come for you. And everything I know is telling me that this is the wrong way to go. Every single place I've been, it's always more concrete, encroaching on the green, riding on your economic wave. When it crashes to the shore, there won't be nothing left to say. But this is where we make our stand. You might own the courtrooms, but the people own the land. It was a time of redemption, a season most strange. Rednecks and hippies agreeing for a change. But it's not just us extremists with our shotguns and fleas. This is such insanity that everyone agrees. And everything you know should be telling you that this is the wrong way to go. Every single place I've seen, it's always more concrete, encroaching on the green, riding on your economic wave. While you eat your own children and dig your coal seam grave, but this is where we